Well, here we are. Lana Donna Kitchen talks about food. Lana Donna Kitchen talks recipes. Lana Donna Kitchen talks about lots of other things on KHOI Radio.
Woo!
We are the Lana Donna Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And Donna Priskintas.
And we're here to talk about things in central Iowa that can be eaten, enjoyed, grown. We talk about food. We talk about farming. We talk about recipes.
Culture. We got culture in here.
And lots of culture, too. So today we're going to be talking about soups and such. And because we keep putting it off, we've got to want to talk about beans first. Beans are soup. So, Donna, do you have any words of wisdom about beans?
Well, my first basic premise is don't buy them in cans. Just cook them. And it's all about timing. Sometimes I cover them up with water before I go to bed, drain them off in the morning. That shortens the cooking time. There's all these things about beans and gas, right?
Oh, I've heard that, yes.
Yeah. So I do various things that I'm not sure if it's even a... It doesn't hurt, let's say that. So I change the... sometimes I... after I've soaked them, then I put them in fresh water, then I bring them to a boil, then I pour the water off because some people say that helps, and then I restart them over again, or sometimes I add epazote.
Oh, epazote. I've heard of it. That's something one can grow in one's garden?
I think it would grow around here.
Or you can get it. It's an herb, right? It's an herb?
It's an herb. It's a leafy green herb, and you... You know, I started using it in Southern California because it kind of grows wild everywhere, like the way lemon balm does around here, you know. But you can buy it, and it has a little flavor, but it's not terribly flavor-changing. So those are just things that I try. Do you have any... I've also heard that putting a piece of kombu in it will break it down as well. None of these things I can guarantee you. These are just acquired wisdoms that don't hurt.
Right. That's to take away the fear of beans. Beans are a wonderful thing to have as a ingredient in soup or just to eat as beans, but we're going to be talking about soup today. There's beans are usually terribly plentiful along about midsummer. Beans exist either as green beans, shell beans, or dry beans. Donna was talking about dry beans because this is the time of the year when you've got dry beans. Green beans are the wonderful green things we find in the summer, and everyone enjoys green beans. You notice if you break open a green bean, there's not much little seed pod in the inside, although they're growing, that's the idea, that's where they come from. You eat the whole pod for green beans. Shell beans are in between the green stage and the dry bean stage. Shell beans are shelled out of the pod just as the pod becomes dry. I've, over the past years in my garden, started growing beans that I can use as shell beans and then also use as dry beans. So catching them about halfway through, you get beans that look like dry beans, but they're a little soft. You can puncture them with your thumbnail.
Plus, they cook a lot faster.
In other words, they have a lot of moisture left in. At this stage, just when the pods are dry in your garden and the pods are full, you can feel them, you can get these shell beans out of your out of the pods.
You want to mention some varieties of shell beans?
Sure. The two varieties that I have grown successfully are the cranberry bean, and there's lots of different kinds of cranberry beans. There's speckled cranberry beans, Vermont cranberry beans, true red cranberry beans. You can find them in seed catalogs, usually right next to the ones that are called green beans, and they're called shell beans or dry beans. And I've had really good luck with the cranberry beans. I actually save the seeds every year and plant them. Also, these are a pinkish, reddish bean, the true red cranberry bean is very red.
Like just a kidney bean or something?
Like a kidney bean, a little smaller. The speckled cranberry bean or the Vermont cranberry bean is a little speckledy, and they're very pretty. They're pinkish and reddish speckled, and they're lovely. They either use as a dry bean, and they're a little softer pink, or they dry down to a darker red and keep a very long time, too. I was thinking of beans because I was shelling my cranberry beans during the New Year's Eve or New Year's Day rebroadcast of the Vienna Philharmonic New Year's Day Johann Strauss waltz program, and somehow the beans hitting my bowl, going plink 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 plink. It just worked so nicely. It was a nice way to start the new year. I think
Lana is recommending that you shell beans to a waltz. Is that true?
It's quite nice. It's a nice don't. It's a long process. It's like knitting or anything else. Sit in front of a. Oh, Masterpiece Theater or something.
You know, I can remember my grandmother and those of her generation, once they got, you know, kind of too elderly to be up and about that much, though, they were always sitting in some kind of rocking chair with their hands, either shelling beans or, well, certainly tatting and crocheting, but mostly things like pitting cherries and cutting, you know, always something with the hands. Busy, 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 busy.
It's a nice thing to do with your hands because you don't have to think too hard. And you look down after a little while and you've got a whole bowl full of these good things. And the husks that are left over all go under my chickens. So it's part of chicken bedding, too. You never waste.
You know what I think? And sometimes when my brain is all muddled and I have some, like, major problem to solve, I always go into the kitchen and start cooking something, because when my hands are busy, I think my brain processes better.
Oh, I think so, too.
So we're coming shelling beans for your sanity. How about that?
That's good. That's a little thing you can do.
We were going to talk about these beans. I was in France last summer, and there was this very sweet little old lady who was quite interested in the fact that I was a chef, and she kept wanting to serve me local delicacies. So she went down into her freezer and produced this bag called Coco de Pampelais, because it was in Pampal, which is on the coast of Brittany, and it's a very, well, like most regions in France or anywhere else, they're very distinct in their cultural traditions. So this was a bean that was only grown in that part of the country, and it actually even had a restricted name. For example, only the families that traditionally have grown this bean are allowed to sell them as the true cocoa beans, and they come at a certain time of year, and they are of the variety where you let them dry and you pick them, but you eat them right away. So there's a season, like a 6-week season. It's very cherished. People really look forward to it. So she had shelled these and frozen a little bag, and she told me how to cook them with lots of carrots and onions. And I have to say, they were absolutely, perhaps, the best bean I'd ever tasted. So I brought home a package that Lana's going to try and grow this year, and we'll see. But I noticed when I went to the store to try to buy the beans, you cannot actually buy them. On the package, it says type Pampelais, which means it's not the authentic one named as the Pampal de Coco de Pampal. But every place has their bean. What do we have? Like in the South, there's a
Vidalia onions.
Or butter beans come up in Virginia and in North Carolina, and everyone rushes to the market because there's only a season for them. And it's, you know, it's rather like the AOC of wines, you know. So we can perhaps develop a distinct bean for Ames.
That sounds good. And is this the spelling of?
Well, it's in French. C-O-C-A-G-N-E, Cocagne. Du Pampelais. Right. So Pampelais is the name of the town. So it's very geographically specific. Other kinds of beans that we wanted to be sure to mention were lentils, all the pulses, red lentils, which are very quick to cook. Brown lentils take a little bit longer. Then there's split peas, yellow and green. And all of these things make wonderful bases for soups.
Great. And before we move on to soups, I think we should take a little time for a little bit of culture in our story here. I have got a book of poems by humorist and poet Roy Blunt Jr., and he wrote a whole bunch of songs to food. And this is his song to beans. Here goes. Boston baked green, red navy lima, pinto black butter, kidney string, I'm a person who leans towards all kinds of beans. I hope that plenty of farmers sow 'em. You're not anywhere till you know 'em. No accident beans. In common speech means, well, are you anything other than prim? Have your kinness, spirit, vim? Can you make all kinds of scenes? Then we say you're full of beans. Eat no beans, Pythagoras said. Where was his head? Yankee, Pole, Hmong, Kentucky Wonder, wax, soy, speckled, they all come under the heading of beans. Flavor apart, they are good for your heart.
I'd forgotten about mung beans. And adzuki beans. We used to make pâtés out of mung beans in our vegetarian years with walnuts. Mung beans and walnuts, I believe, made a bean loaf or something like that.
Did you want to mention sage butter?
Oh, we're going to give some little recipe hints. One of my favorite bean soups, aside from chili, which I'm sure everybody has their own version of, that wonderful, ubiquitous, warming winter food, is a white bean, or some people call them cannellini, not to be mistaken for lima beans, which are delicious on their own right, but they produce a very different thing. So I do a white bean soup where I cook the beans from scratch, and then throw in some onions, and then you can either cook them till they're really, really, really soft and discreet, or you can puree them if you like, and you can put chicken stock in if you want, or some such like that. But the deep flavoring of it is brown butter sage. So this is the brown butter sage idea. You take butter, and you can either clarify it, which is best because you are going to burn it, kind of. So clarifying butter simply means you melt it and you kind of pour off the white bits.
Pour off the white bits.
Or you can buy ghee. What it is you're getting to just oil with no dairy in it.
Oh.
Of course, sometimes I don't bother doing that. I just throw the butter in the pan. And then.
How much butter?
As much as you want.
Okay.
Depends on how much sage and how many beans.
Mm-hmm.
But be generous. So, but the basic thing is to make brown butter sage is you take the whole leaf of the sage, not the stem, just the leaf, of fresh sage, which you can usually buy at the market any time of year.
Or it is one of those things that can grow pretty well in a pot on your windowsill. So,
and it's perennial, isn't it?
It's a perennial.
So does yours last through the winter here?
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. No, not outside. I tend to move them into the greenhouse.
Okay.
I have had luck wintering over my sage only if I cover them a whole lot with leaves, and this is a hard winter. I doubt if I'll have any outside, but I do have some in the greenhouse and some in a pot on the windowsill.
So you take those little nicely smelling sage leaves, and you cook them in the butter till they actually turn black. They're not burned.
Black.
You know, they go through brown, they wither, they keep going as far as you can push them without the whole thing like completely going up in smoke. And then you take all that butter and all those leaves and you stir them into, they'll be brittle, so you can crush them or you can put them in the soup and puree them. Or they're also really good if your soup is not a soup, you can make a mixed bean dip out of it, like a hummus, only with white beans. And, oh, yes, of course, you have to have cooked some garlic into the beans. So you could have a white bean dip, or you can have a soup, and you just kind of stir it in, and the flavor, oh, and it also works really well with a little squash, brown butter sage and squash, or pasta dishes are really, it's a kind of traditional Italian, goes well with light tomatoes, stuff like that. So, you know what else we didn't mention about beans is hummus.
Oh, good. Yeah, go ahead. Hummus sounds great.
I am not a fan of the ubiquitous hummus that we buy because most of it is not, I think, profoundly flavored enough. So cooking chickpeas is actually really, really easy. I often cook a bunch and then kind of bag them up and freeze them so I can make a fresh hummus very easily. Fresh hummus, the classic is in the blender, is hummus, olive oil, tahini, lemon juice, garlic, and salt and pepper. Obviously, you can add a lot of other things to that, like some of Lana's famous dried tomatoes. I like to put in preserved lemons, which we'll have to do a whole show about preserved lemons.
Oh, that sounds
wonderful. Yeah, it's really delicious. So anyway, I would encourage you to eat your beans. It's a great roughage and
good for your heart.
And protein dense.
Oh, very.
Yeah.
There's something about beans this time of year, also done in a crock pot. You can cook them slow and you feel like you've really eaten something.
Yeah, and it's like so easy. You put them on and forget about them. That's my favorite thing. So
also, another little side about beans in a crock pot, any of these kind of beans can work. Finding some really nice bacon or ham to flavor your slow-cooked beans is real fun. And here we are in the middle of Iowa. Find yourself a really good pig farmer. Yes, there's some really fine bacon that is out there, all kinds. And you don't need much, but that bit of flavor, it's one of my favorites. So there we have it.
Lana and I had a soup last night. Now, we were going to talk about the difference between soup and stew. As far as I know, it has to do with how thick it is. You know, like the soup we had last night could have been stew, but because we were having soups today on air, I made it thinner with more stock. And it had two things in it, which you don't normally have to do, but I was cleaning out the freezer. So I found some nice smoked ham hocks from Cindy Madsen, who is a local Iowa grower, and I also had an oxtail, which is cow tail, basically.
Sounds good.
Do you have an oxtail song?
I do. Actually, I'm going to read Merriam-Webster's definition of soup, and then we'll go to a song, and then we'll talk about oxtails. Because that was my question. Exactly, where does one find all these oxes? But first off, the definition of soup. Soup, number one, a liquid food with stock at its base and often containing pieces of solid food. Number two, something having the consistency of soup. Number three, an unfortunate predicament. And that really truly is what it says in the Merriam-Webster dictionary that I have, so that's fine. Let's go to, there's a song I'd like to share with you. It's called Bull at the Wagon by the Barn Owl Band, so let's go into that.
Thank you.
yes, that was Bullet the Wagon by the Barn Owl Band. Some fine fiddling there. Yes, yes, yes. Bullet the Wagon. Bullet the Wagon has a tail. And,
T-A-I-L.
Yeah, T-A-I-L. Right. We're going to talk about a little about oxtails because I've heard of that a lot and it always sounded good. And like Donna mentioned, it makes really good soup. And I assume that that really truly means the tail. With all of the other meat on a cow, why the tail?
Well, the tail has, of course, vertebrae in it. And each of the little, I mean, each of the little vertebrae has a lot of cartilage and that sort of thing. So when you cook it in a liquid or a long, slow cook, all of those things kind of come out and they're very unctuous. They thicken the soup. They're very rich. As I was putting it in last night, I was, sometimes people will leave, I mean, I take all the bones out once it's cooked off the meat, but sometimes people will leave the little, oogie bits in the plate, you know, but I have to say, if you eat those are what have joint building things in them, and they're very, very healthy. So I encourage us to get over our, you know, they say the conscious way to, if you're going to kill an animal and take its life, it would be incumbent upon us to fully utilize the whole beast. So there's like a book called Using the Nasty Bits, which of course are not nasty. They're very, very delicious. So oxtails are a good example. After all, they're rare. Every cow only has one. And they do make a good soup or stew just for that reason.
Sounds good. Using everything from snout to tail sounds like a very
good thing.
That's right. So, talk about starting out soups.
Well, first of all, I'm just going to get back to your definition because, of course, I'm so stuck in the culinary thing that the third definition of soup as being an unfortunate predicament. Here's where my mind went. When you have a bunch of stuff you don't know what to do with, that's an unfortunate predicament, and you throw it all in the soup. Now, that was my brain being really, really literal there, but soup is kind of good for that. You know, you can mix and match all kinds of things.
Wonderful way to clean out your refrigerator and or freezer,
exactly.
And it all ends up good. All right. Soup.
Bases of soup. Okay, there's the usual stock. The easiest one, I think, is chicken stock. I know we've talked about this before, so I'll go over it very quickly. I just throw the whole chicken in a pot with water and bay leaves and nothing more and cook it when the meat comes off at about 45 minutes in, unless it's an old chicken. I pull the whole thing out, let it cool and take the meat off, put all the bones and the skin and the bits and the feet, if you have them, should go back in. And then I just keep cooking on a slow boil. So, chicken stock is very easy to make. Beef stock, I wish I knew the chemistry, but you actually roast the beans, the bones first, and then put them in the stock with bay leaves again, according to me, and cook that for a long time. I will often simmer these soups overnight, or a crock pot is a good way to do it. Just put it on and forget about it, except that your whole house starts to smell really heavenly.
You won't forget about it.
No, you won't. Other soup bases, coconut milk for Asian flavored ones and curry. Of course, there are vegetable stocks too. I tend not, I have to say, my personal admission here is there's only one bought stock prepared that I use, and that is it's a mushroom broth. It comes in an aseptic package and it's called Pacific something or other. And that actually has enough flavor that I think it's worth getting. Generally, if you buy a chicken stock, or heaven forbids, you should use a bouillon cube. They have other things in them that, like, hydrolyzed protein and stuff like that, and none of those things really give you the flavor you want. So I'm sort of want to really encourage everybody. Making stock is not only it's thrifty, it's delicious, it's certainly more health-giving than anything you buy. Other bases, miso, which is fermented soybeans and sometimes other beans. There's light miso, dark miso. Now miso is generally a living thing. So sometimes what you want to do is boil your water, make your soup, and then as it starts to cool down enough to eat it, you kind of thin your miso with water and stir it into the soup. That way, I mean, if you want all the live probiotic benefits of it. If you don't care and you just want it for a flavor, put it in any old time.
Miso is something that one purchases at a store?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I suppose if we were really ingenious and, you know, we could make our own and people do it, but not too much around here. It's an Asian thing. Other soup bases, obviously tomatoes. Canned tomatoes make great soup bases. A really simple thing that I do, like for vegetables, this is something I used to feed my daddy in his dotage, was I would just take some water, a couple bay leaves, some potatoes, kind of roughly, you know, not whole, so they cook faster, some onions, and I just put it in and cook it until the vegetable softened, and pulled out the bay leaves, put it in the food processor or the blender, or using an immersion blender, which is really handy with soups, and then I just make a puree out of it with milk or cream. Now, you can do that with cauliflower. You can make a cream of carrot soup. There's any number of vegetables, or a mixed root vegetable soup is great, too. You could do it with, turnips are a little dominating, but you could use celery root, rutabaga, potatoes, carrots, all those kinds of things. So that's not quite making a vegetable stock, although people do make vegetable stocks. I'm not terribly fond of them because they don't seem strong enough.
You mentioned cream of something. Does cream of something mean that cream is in the soup?
Usually.
Or milk.
And dairy-based.
And yeah. One should add that first, last, when?
Well, like with the potato soup, I usually put it in last. Although, I mean, you can cook with milk, but it's just easier to add it during the, you know, thinning, pureeing stage like that.
That sounds good.
Yeah, and that's infinitely variable. Another kind of soup that I have been particularly fond of lately is rice congee. So that's, I first had that in Hong Kong.
Oh, and lovely. Spell congee.
C-O-N-G-E-E, oh. I do believe. So it's made with stock, either chicken or beef, and you boil the rice. Now, I think the traditional one is probably white rice, but I actually use short grain brown rice. And I simmer it until it's like oatmeal-ish, very, very soft and soupy. And you can make this as thick or thin as you want. So, like, these last few days, especially when it's just me cooking for myself, I'll have a pot of that in the fridge, and then I'll take it out and warm it up, and then into it you can drop all kinds of things like bacon bits, scallions, cilantro. You know, you could cook vegetables into it. You can, spice it up, put something hot in it. Speaking of which, I was going to talk about herbs this was true. We were going to talk about garnishes for soup, too. The first thing, obviously, is, you know, bread and soup is the classic. You could do cornbread and soup or tortillas, and I'll do a tortilla soup recipe in a little bit. And but garnishes that you actually put on top, like, for example, if you take a butternut squash, roast it in the oven or cook it in water, scrape it out of the peel, put it in the blender with either its own liquid or stock, chicken or water, doesn't really matter, or mushroom stock that we were talking about, and then you heat it up after it's blended, and then you can serve it as you're putting it into the bowl. You dollop on something like either fresh homemade croutons, which are really, really good. Just put your old bread in the oven and kind of toast it. You can rub herbs in it if you want, or garlic olive oil or something like that. Or fresh herbs if you want to go Asian, a little cilantro, some scallions. You can even just drop parsley in it for color. And often soups, particularly if they're Italian in nature, they put a splash of good, fresh, raw olive oil on the top of the soup just before they serve it, like a minestrone, which is an Italian vegetable soup or something like that. So it's just something you put on at the last minute after it's in the bowl when you're serving it.
So we're talking about like serving, drizzling in individual little cups or individual little bowls. Speaking of serving, is it take away from the left and serve from the right, or take away from the right and serve from the left?
Here's how I always remember. RR, remove from the right, which means you serve from the left.
Serve from the left, remove from the right. That is probably very important since we're trying to add a little bit of culture here to the middle of Iowa, and everyone is watching that Downton Abbey show where everyone is served. So remember, it's served from the left and take away from the right.
And we should talk about bowls, too, the proper bowls
yes.
for soup. The concept is that the larger and flatter the bowl, the more quickly the soup will cool. So if you're doing a soupy, stewy, thick, with hot bits in it, you might want to use a flatter, not a flat plate, obviously, but one
shallow.
A shallow, broader bowl. And if you're doing something a little that might cool off too quickly, you use a deeper cup, because the less exposure the top has to the air, supposedly that will maintain the temperature a little bit more.
Anyway. Serve from the left, take away from the right. Got it.
And there's one other bit of etiquette.
Etiquette.
Little boats go out to sea. What does that mean? This is what I was told as a child, okay? That means you take your spoon, your soup spoon, and you put it in the soup closest to you and take it away from you to fill it up. Now, of course, I'm quite guilty of not doing that. But the reason behind that is as you lift your soup spoon out of the soup, it's more likely to drip in the bowl than down the front of your dress. So little boats go out to sea.
Lovely. I remember that as advice, but I never had the bit of poetry to go with it, and now I know. That's good. I looked in your silverware drawer the other day, and you had an amazing collection of spoons, and I couldn't believe how big those spoons were that you call soup spoons. I must have a small mouth. These things were, like, really big. So spoons come in the teaspoon and, of course, the demi-tasse spoons are teeny tiny. But when you get into soup spoons, they tend to be really big honkers.
I guess that's so that you can get a good mouthful. Sometimes it's unfortunate, but I have a proclivity to collect any kind of culinary antique that I find in the local auctions. And also, all the silverware at my house is mismatched silver patterns, silver plate, of course. But I just love all of them. And there's very different sizes of soup spoons. Now, the kind I grew up in the Midwest is the kind of longer, pointy, that we sometimes also called tablespoon, as opposed to, and then there are larger, of course, serving spoons. But I noticed one time when I was just past college, there was a particular pattern that I had grown up with at home, a silver pattern. And when I went to a friend's house, lo and behold, they had the same silver pattern. And I thought, oh, how marvelous. But it was on the East Coast, and it had a different shape of silver spoon, even within the same pattern. They were completely round rather than the long. So I have quite a few of those that I really enjoy, too. So there are various kinds of soup spoons. The idea is that they are larger than a teaspoon to hold a little bit more of a mouthful.
And if you're setting a pretty table, and if you have soup as the first course, where do you put the soup spoon if you're laying out a table service?
Well, the rule of thumb is, of course, the spoons are on the right with the knife, but you're supposed to basically put the furthest out would be the first utensil that you use. So the soup spoon, it would be from the inside out, it would be the knife, the dessert spoon, then the soup spoon. Just like on the left, it's closest to the plate is the dinner fork, then the salad fork, et cetera, like that.
Good. I mean, if we're going to have soup, we might as well ingest it nicely. so.
Deliciously.
Deliciously.
I was going to also talk about, well, I was going to give you a recipe here. This is called a silky coconut pumpkin soup, and it is from Hot, Sour, Salty, Sweet by Jeffrey Alford and Naomi Duguid. Duguid, I believe it is. No, Duguid. They have incredible pictures in their book. And I invariably do this one. And I don't use pumpkin. I am always a fan of using kabocha squash or any of those deeper, darker, greener. You could even do it with butternut. And it calls for cooking the pumpkins in the coconut milk.
Oh.
In chunks.
Peeled?
Well, she actually peels it and then cooks it. I, who am really lazy, I will just roast it and then scoop it out so it's not really in squares. It's kind of in lumps.
Good. It's really hard to peel a squash.
But yeah.
It can be done. It can be done. I like roasting.
But the basic idea is to get the cooked squash into the coconut milk. She uses also chicken broth and coconut milk in equal parts. It's delicious that way. You can add water. We do use canned coconut milk, although in many parts of the world that would be considered just like using canned stock. But
right, we don't have a whole lot of free-range coconuts here.
No, we don't. So anyway, it's basically the coconut milk and the squash and 2 tablespoons of Thai fish and black pepper. And then it's like one of these things that you cook them all together with an onion. She uses a shallot, but onion is fine. So it's kind of chunky in a coconut base with the Thai fish sauce. And then at the end, you put in the loosely packed coriander leaves and fresh scallion. So it's like one of those other soups that I was mentioning where you garnish at the end with a lot of fresh things, or like in the congee. Another good thing to do with coconut milk base is using red lentils and a curry sauce of any kind and putting in some live vegetables to suit yourself, you know, carrots, even a little tomato. So coconut milk is good with any kinds of curry. We were going to get into, oh, I do want to talk about peppers. Well, actually, first let's talk about the savory herbs. In winter soups, my standard go-to is marjoram. Not margarine, marjoram, sweet marjoram. It's a little like basil, but more wintry and hearty. And I have to say, I cook with it all the time.
Sounds lovely. I just want to take this opportunity to say this is the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI Radio. All right, on with herbs.
Herbs, thyme is a good one in the winter. Rosemary is really good, but it's very particular, you know. Too much rosemary is not a good herb. It gets too strong. And, of course, bay leaves. Everywhere, bay leaves.
And also, my experience is that you fish the bay leaves out and you fish the rosemary out because they don't really cook down and they kind of get stuck in your teeth.
So, well, it depends. If you chop the rosemary really, really fine, and sometimes, like, I'll make a squash soup, which is nothing but the squash, which has been boiled, the water reserved from the boiling, you scoop it out, you put it in the blender, you add the water from the boiling and whatever other water you need to thin it. Then you take a little pan of olive oil, chop the rosemary very fine in it, and cook the little bits of rosemary in the olive oil. Then you put that in the blender with salt and pepper. Mush the whole thing together, and voila, you have a delicious soup.
Mushing sounds like a wonderful idea.
Yeah, in the blender.
Let's take a little bit of a music break here, and we'll listen to a bit of a waltz. So if you are in your kitchen, grab your cat and waltz around the kitchen table. If you're in your office, find yourself a willing coworker. And if you don't know how to waltz, look at your coworker or your cat in the eye. And as the music goes on, step to one side, step to the other side, step to one side, step to the other side. ¶¶ Welcome back to the Donna Lana Kitchen.
Waltzing around the Donna Lana Kitchen.
Hope you enjoyed your little waltz break there. That was the Cloud Forest Waltz by the Barn Owl Band. If you feel like keeping your feet moving, look up the Central Iowa Barn Dance on the CIBD.org. Barn dancing happens in the Central Iowa area once a month.
And Lana is a barn dance caller.
Yeah, I haven't lost a dancer yet, so come and join us. It's it's kind of like the most fun you can have with your clothes on. Yes, yes. Now we're going to go back to talking about food, and we're talking about soups and such today. Don is going to tell us about tortilla soup.
Okay, tortilla soup, or even eggs ranchero, which is somewhat related. You start with the chicken stock. And tortilla soup, which looks like it has a lot of tomato, doesn't. Really, the base of it is ancho chili. That's A-N-C-H-O, which is a chili which gives a lot of red color with not much heat.
Is ancho and poblano, no, the two different chilies?
Two different chilies.
Ancho is kind of a pear shape.
Well, you know what? I always buy it in a powder.
Ah,
it's readily available that way. So it's as simple as taking your chicken stock, dumping in your ancho, throwing in a few onions, a couple of carrots for color, and then you tear up some corn, not wheat, but corn tortillas or corn chips, and you kind of cook that until the corn dissolves enough to thicken the soup. And then you add fresh lime juice, not the bottled kind, fresh really makes it happen, you know, salt and pepper to taste, and then you put some of your chicken back in, and then you top it once again with scallions and chopped cilantro. When you serve that part at the table, you can also serve it with, people like to put grated cheese on it, cheddar mostly, or even sour cream. And to make eggs ranchero, which is another idea for any soup, is that's basically taking an almost chili-like substance, wet, and then you poach eggs on the top of it, and to just till they're soft. The white gets cooked, and the yolk is still runny, and then you kind of try to lift it out without breaking the yolk into a bowl, which is also good on congee. Potato soup would be good that way. So you're adding this extra meal essence into it by having an egg. The other thing that we didn't talk about is egg drop soup.
You find egg drop soup on menus, and I've never had the courage to make it myself.
Well, you can do the sort of Chinese-y version, which is a kind of a sweet and sour soup base with vegetables and probably chicken in it or something like that. Or the Greek way, which that soup is called avagomundo. Now, if anybody Greek is listening and I've said that wrong, my apologies. But avagomundo is really rice, chicken stock, minus the chicken usually, or maybe a little chicken, and lemon in it. And then you, to make an egg drop soup, you break the egg into, not into the soup pot, but into a separate, like, little bowl or something. And you kind of mix the white and the yolk, and then you pour it into the hot soup with just one swirl. If you stir it too much, you won't get the strands. You have to stir it just enough to disperse it a little so it comes out in those little strings that you like to see.
The little whites, what happens to the yellow bits?
Well, they've already kind of been mixed in with the whites, so it's okay. Homogeneous, and you just pour the egg in, and if you overstir it, you'll just incorporate it into the soup. It's hard to understir it, but if you want those nice little eggy strands, you stir it into the hot soup while it's still on the stove, and let it sit, like a minute or two, just enough to cook the egg, and then you end up with egg drop soup. So that's another kind of soup. I did want to talk just a little bit about peppers under seasonings. There's black pepper, which I use in everything, pink peppercorns, which are it's actually not in the pepper tree, but they are delicious, and sometimes you'll buy those mixed pepper blends that have pink, green, and black.
Right,
but I tend to mix my own pink, and I know you can they don't have pink peppercorns, I don't think, anywhere in town, but I order them from Penzi Spices online. Then there are other kinds of, you know, cayenne, which is a fairly hot, it's a heat without a lot of pepper flavor. Aleppo pepper I use because it has more of a pepper flavor with a little less heat. There's the traditional Italian red pepper flakes, which, you know, go into pastas and things like that.
I remember once mentioning white pepper, and you stepped back aghast.
Oh, it's true. I know a lot of people swear by white pepper. I don't like it. I think it smells cruddy. And a lot of people,
we're talking acquired taste.
Yeah, well, yes. I think so. I mean, other people use it, you know, and it's quite a culinary thing, but it's, I think people started using it in white sauces because they didn't want black pepper flakes in their white sauce. Mm-hmm. But I'm going with the black pepper flakes in my white sauce.
Well, we have about pretty much peppered ourselves out there. We've been talking about soup day. This is Donna Lana Kitchen. And we've been talking about food and soup and stay warm out there. Let's go into another. And dance, eat. Eat good soup.
And make merry.
And make merry.